You're listening to the Live Free Now podcast, bringing you the news, views, tips, and tools you can use to live a free, prosperous, and healthy life. Find us online at livefreenow.show. And now your host, John Bush. All right, we are live. This is John Bush with the Live Free Now podcast, bringing you news, views, tips, and tools you can use to live a free, prosperous life. I have a very special guest that's joining us today, Mr. Jack Spierko of the Survival Podcast. And today we're going to chat all about survival tips, not just surviving, but thriving. We're going to talk about COVID-19 and all things that are good. So it's a great honor to have Jack on the program. How are you doing today, Jack?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good, man.
Excellent. All right. Well, you're looking good on the surprise video
COVID
interview.
Cut, you know, they shut down the barber shop, so I finally let my wife cut my hair with a wall razor.
there you go.
They're open again now, but, you know.
Who needs them?
Well, my gal's going to charge me more to fix it if I go to her with it like this. So I need to let it grow out.
There you go. just a couple show notes. This is the first time doing an interview on StreamYard here, and I'm tethered to my phone because there's some internet issues. So if we have connectivity problems for you viewing live, then just bear with us, and the stream will pop back in as soon as I get it sorted out. And you're not going to want to miss this interview because we're going to keep you captivated and informed the whole time. So let's just start with an introduction about yourself, Jack. Of course, all this COVID stuff started popping off, and I shared at one point we're all survivalists now. Arguably, for many people, we're all socialists now with all the money being doled out. But you were uniquely poised in this situation because your history is educating people about surviving in good times or bad. Well, here we are in bad times. So just chat a little about what got you into the whole survivalism culture and about your podcast, and we can go from there.
Yeah, I mean, survivalist is a perfectly good word that's been destroyed in the modern age. I was a survivalist and grew up as a survivalist when nobody used the term. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, we were prepared for things like power to go off, because if you weren't, then you froze to death. And we grew a garden because we were poor, so if you didn't, you didn't have any food. And I guess today that makes you a survivalist, and back then it just made you somebody that lived in a coal region of Pennsylvania. And like a lot of people from small town, rural America, I eventually grew up, moved out, went somewhere else for the opportunity because working in the coal mines didn't seem like a good idea, built a successful professional career, and left my roots. And it was probably 9/11 that really most brought me back around. I ended up a long way from home on 9/11, stuck in an airport. Well, not really an airport, stuck, you know, after landing in an airport because of the shutdown. And having to listen to my kid cry and wonder, you know, if he was going to be okay, if it was going to be safe, all that while I was away from home. And it really started my journey back toward my roots. I went back to gardening and things like that so that at least I could control my own life. Because what I had realized, I'd become really successful, but I had also become successful at someone else's control. Like, people could decide for me whether or not I was going to be successful tomorrow. So I have a great job today. Do I have one tomorrow? Well, we'll see how that works. And what have you done for us lately in sales type of thing? So I started that journey back. I started building companies of my own shortly after that. And but I didn't go professionally with preparedness until 2008. I saw the financial crash coming from a mile away. I had a client in one of my companies that wanted a podcast. Podcasting was new back then. Like, not everybody knew what the hell a podcast was or even how to do it. So I bid the job with no idea how to actually deliver the podcast. We got the job. My web guy was like, yeah, I can do all this, but I don't know the feeds and iTunes submission and all that. I'm like, I'll figure that out. So I actually started my podcast so that I would know how to deliver a product for a customer. And when I did that, I'm like, you know, preparedness is in my blood. I love teaching. And all I had was the time in my car. So I started the show in my car. I did the show in my car for about a year and a half, took the show full time in 2010, and have been doing that ever since. And what I built was all built on what I call a philosophy of modern survivalism. And I did that because as a marketer, I wanted something I could hang my hat on that wasn't somebody else's. So I started thinking about all of the things of preparedness and how we handle them and the way that the media used survivalism. And I wanted survival for the hook, but what I really wanted to teach was preparedness. So I started thinking of different terminology. And when I came to modern survivalist and modern survivalism and put quotes around it and threw it in Google, there was like one result, and it wasn't used as a phrase. It was like a sentence ended Marvel, modern and started in survival. So I was like, yeah, that's what we'll do. So we called it that basically to mean that we talk about all the primitive skills. We talk about homesteading skills and stuff like that, but we won't turn away from using something like modern technology, like Zello for communications, or I know you're big into the Freedom Cells and stuff like that. That uses all leverages, modern technology, GPS, et cetera. We use all that, but kind of like when back when you and I went to school, John, they taught us how to do math, and then they taught us how to use a calculator, right? They taught us how to do both, and they taught us common sense math, and you needed to know how to do both because you might not have a calculator at some point. Maybe that's not true anymore, but your GPS may not work. I've had it not work. So modern survivalism is all about being prepared for the systems to fail, but not being unwilling to use the things that are modern technology while they're available.
Sure. So it's kind of a more practical approach where you can still integrate with modern society. You don't have to necessarily be all bugged out in the woods by yourself.
That sucks.
It's a kind of a easy life. Yeah, I picked up on that. There's always a balance between, even with anarchism or voluntarism, where it's like, how consistent and pure do you want to be? Do you want to be 100% agorist and not have any checking account, which limits your ability to do business? Do you want to not pay income tax? Do you want to not have a driver's license and have the risk of getting pulled over and just having to deal with all that headache? Or do you want to kind of obey which laws are convenient, which don't make you feel so dirty? Is it kind of similar to that, where you just strike a balance between one of the polars, which is bugging out in the woods all by yourself with your shotgun in your hand at all times, and the other one, which is enjoying a trip to Whole Foods every once in a while? Or
sure.
Is that what kind of...
Well, and the other way to look at it, see, think about a survivalist. What that word actually means is survival or to continue. And is, okay, right, is a suffix that means to specialize in. So survivalist, mm-hmm, actually is a person that specializes in surviving. Well, I don't know how much time a lot of these people that call themselves purists but aren't have ever actually spent in the wilderness on their own with no systems of support, but it's a really good way to get dead. So if you actually are someone that specializes in survival, you specialize in setting up systems in your life to support your continued existence. And alone in the woods, I mean, you might as well spend your 75 years, 85 years of life in a room alone with the curtains drawn eating navy beans then. You'll survive, but will you really enjoy it? I like people. I like to go out. I like to do things. I like to have modern conveniences. I just believe in systems of redundancy. So if those things fail, I have something to fall back on. Yeah. The purist is always interesting because you'll show people like, well, here's a basic way to start a fire with a lighter. Because believe it or not, people don't know how to start a fire with a lighter. Instead they're trying, sure, to light a log that's this big or something. Like, yeah, you'll never survive without friction fire or whatever. And it's like, sure, do you drive a car? Do you have a, yeah, car? Do you have a refrigerator? Oh, you do? Then shut up, if that makes, sure, sense.
I hear you. Okay, well, I want to talk about your practical skills and strategies in the context of COVID, because obviously, sure, that's what is in everyone's face and some people's bodies. So you and I have a very similar take on COVID. And it seems like as time goes on, as long as you're not completely hard-headed and you're willing, for some people, willing to admit that perhaps they got it wrong, more and more people are seeing through the veil that the state, that the WHO, that the government's put up. Trump seems to be a little bit more on the side of reason through this whole thing. But why don't you just give us an overview of your take on COVID? Is it as bad as the media is saying? Is it completely illegitimate, a total fraud? Or maybe is it somewhere there in the middle? What are your thoughts on COVID?
I think somewhere in the middle is a good place to start that. Exactly what the middle is, though, is like, if you have two ends like this, is the middle dead center? Or is it, leaning to one side or the other is really the way to look at this. And I think that there's so many layers to this that how far on the spectrum we are from the story that we're given versus the story that is changes depending on what aspect you're talking about with it. There is a virus, and they call it COVID SARS-2. It is relatively new. I believe that. I don't believe there is no virus, or it's 5G or something like that. It is a new novel coronavirus, which my response to that, though, is we have new novel coronaviruses every year, year in, year out. I had something this year. I haven't been antibody tested yet, but my gut is when I get antibody tested, like a lot of people that have had this weird thing that's similar to COVID, I probably won't have had COVID-19. Based on the infection rate in Texas being now estimated at 3%, there's a 97% chance that it wasn't COVID. So what about that virus? How many people died from that virus this year that were called other respiratory infections? So I think the media has obviously taken this and run way too far with it. The other side of it, though, is, John, I these people that say there's nothing or that none of these new deaths are tied to the COVID SARS-2 virus, I don't think that makes sense either. I had people tell me that, and I'm like, well, I have a friend who I've known for 12 years who's an ER doctor in Seattle. So what, the New World Order got to him and he lied to his buddy from 12 years ago? And how many, like, that doesn't work in a conspiracy. So I think it's somewhere in the middle. But I also think that if we look at it, dude, you've been watching the same data I have. It doesn't seem to like the lockdowns really did anything. Like, areas that had a low prevalence of the virus would have had it with or without a lockdown. And areas that had a high prevalence would have had it, you know, without a lockdown or with the lockdown. Didn't matter. As of a month ago, the antibody testing results for New York City were at least 25% of the city had it. That's over 2 million people. So did destroying that economy make sense when a quarter of your population? So I don't know, because they stopped reporting the antibody data. No one wants to talk about it anymore for some reason. So I don't know what it is, but I got to believe it's another 10%. We got to be at like 30, 35% in New York City. So now you're approaching 3.5 million people in New York City, in a city of 8.5 million people had this thing. And then when you look at the death rate compared to that, it's tiny. And then if you were to back out all the people that died in old folks' homes that didn't have to, because Cuomo sent people into those facilities with positive tests, you would pull that number down even further, and you're somewhere well south of 1%. That doesn't mean that it's not terrible when these people died, but the other side of it is when you hear this stuff like, one life is too many. Well, then life sucks, dude, because we have thousands and thousands of people that die every day of various things. So I think it's real. I also think that it was a complete overreaction, and I think you could defend it a little bit in the beginning because people didn't know. Now we have the data, now we know, and none of what we're doing now makes any sense.
Yeah, I agree. There's a chart that has the different political jurisdictions, even states, but also comparing countries. And there's no correlation that can be drawn between the states that locked down and the states that had light lockdowns and the states or countries that had no lockdowns. Now, about the death, like, it's clear that Americans, especially, that's our experience, but it's clear that a lot of people are really, really afraid of death. And obviously, I don't want to die. I don't want to see my family members die, grandparents, great-grandparents. Nobody wants to see anyone they love die. But I think that there's such a fear of death, and people really haven't done the existential work to come to terms with the fact that we're all going to die, that has been really exacerbated. That's exacerbated the problem and people's willingness to basically be further enslaved with all these little micro controls as well. But I'm seeing this crazy phenomenon that's taking place that would seem kind of counterintuitive, and I'd love your take on it. It's that if people are so afraid of death, why do you think that people are so resistant to good news surrounding the virus? Like you just said, I've been banging on these antibody tests as soon as they came out, because originally it was conveyed that it's a 2-4% mortality rate. Even 4% mortality rate was being pushed out there, which seems really scary. Like, that's a lot of people that die to get it. And then the antibody tests come out and we're like, okay, now that we have better data, a more thorough look at who has the virus, and then we take how many people have died in that given area, it looks like the mortality rate is far lower. When information like that is shared in a calm, rational manner, a lot of people seem to resist it and not even want to hear it. Why do you think that is?
So first you got to start out with how they got into the mental state they were in the first place. And it's real easy to see why they wouldn't come out of it. So this is a disease and it does kill people. I think you and I both agree with that. There are people that get this thing and they die. It might be a very small number of healthy people that fall into that. You know, they'll always show you the little kid or the Iron Man guy that almost died or whatever. And it's like, well, you know, there was weird respiratory illness. There was a young, like 33 something sportscaster, pretty famous on ESPN, that died of something very similar to this in December. And it wasn't COVID, as far as they know anyway, and it happened, but we didn't shut down the world because of it. But since it is real, and since people do die from it, disease killing humans in large numbers is as ancient as humans. And it certainly is ancient since humans started domesticating animals. Most of these illnesses are what are called zoonotic illnesses, which means that they come to us from animals. And until we started domesticating cattle and poultry and stuff like that, we got almost none of these. They just didn't happen. And because it's very difficult for nature to make this leap. Why would an illness that infects a buffalo, a water buffalo, infect you? But when you take that buffalo and you domesticate it and it stays with you generation to generation and the viruses co-evolve with the two species, you get the leap and the jump. And as that leap and jump has happened, if you look through history, smallpox alone, of all the times it broke out, estimated by historians, killed 1 billion people. 1 billion people. The plague wiped out, 40 to 60% of the population, depending on whose numbers you believe. Okay, that is hardwired into our ancient genetic memories. That is in us as humans. The same reason that when you're in the woods and something's there that might want to eat you, all of a sudden the hair stands up on the back of your neck. Even though you don't smell it, you don't see it, you don't hear it, there's an innate piece of you that remembers being prey. And then all of a sudden something's going on, whether it's a two-legged predator or a four-legged predator. Hey, everybody's had that experience. You walk into a place, you go, oh, something's wrong here. So when this gets touched by people you trust, experts, it grabs onto that. And that ancient fear that's inside all of us. You and I are not...
The reptilian brain.
Right, yeah. We're not immune to this. I'm going to force myself to use logic and reason to see if this tracks. Most people are not big on forcing themselves to use logic and reason. So now they buy into it. Now they go out and buy so much toilet paper, they build a toilet paper fort to hide in. They go out and they make public statements about how important this all is. And then they start virtue signaling with their masks and everything else. And they do this for a long period of time. And then along comes people like you and me, and we're not experts. We're just quoting other experts who don't happen to have the pulpit of the state and say, hey, this isn't what you think it is. Now, this person's already went out and told everybody they know, all their family, they've accepted the sacrifices, they've justified shutting down the economy, and you want them to stop doing that. Good effing luck. Right? Good luck, because that person has so much of a vested interest. And our old friend that answers so many of these similar questions is back, John. Cognitive dissonance. Now the mind is actually in pain because the new data conflicts with the pre-existing belief. Once a belief is established, changing that belief is far more difficult than establishing the belief. If I had played some cruel trick on you and made sure that everybody that ever knew you told you that orange was blue and blue was orange your whole life, and we made sure that every book you read, then we could go back and even show you the timeline of this being done to you, of you being deceived. We could even show you a video of us all getting together and said, when John's born, we're going to tell him blue is orange and orange is blue. And it would still be very, very difficult for you ever to accept that orange was orange and blue is blue. And that's what you're seeing here. They tied into this ancient fear. And I don't necessarily I'm not big on it's all a plan. I think what happens is incompetence breeds stupidity through the power of the state. And then once you set down a path, the state becomes vested in that, and then they harness it and use it. So I don't think in the beginning, like, they all got together at New World Order headquarters and tied in Bill Gates on a conference call and said, here's what we're going to do. I think what you had is a bunch of governors, a bunch of mayors, the president himself, all going, oh, shit, 2 million Americans are going to die. What do we do? But then once they lay that down and they start to see how they have advantages to it, plus now let's say you are a governor in a state that's still locking down heavily. And you look at this and think, maybe I was wrong. What do you think, John, or the likelihood of that person coming out and going, I got this wrong, we should open back up? Can they do that now, politically? What happens to Cuomo if he comes out and says, we totally screwed this up, we shouldn't have shut down the economy? He's dead, right? I'm asking you.
Yeah, I read in Sweden, actually, they admitted that they made some mistakes as far as not being more secure, not being more forceful with locking down the nursing homes, which a lot of the deaths everywhere are coming from nursing homes. But unfortunately, most politicians, whether it's ego or desire to be reelected, aren't going to shoot you straight. And I think one of the big problems, I feel really optimistic about this not being as much of a problem in the future, is that people are so reliant on authorities, experts, politicians, mainstream media, CDC, WHO, for their source of truth that if the news said it, if the expert, they paraded the doctor out, Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx even, then it absolutely must be true. And I've even noticed people when I start really banging on them with logic and good data, it's not just a conspiracy theory or numbers John's pulling out of his rear end, it's even government numbers, then they start to say, well, there's just so much differing information out there that we can't possibly know. And I did a video recently where I was trying to like encourage people that are maybe a little more weak-minded or even not as strong in their desire for change, to encourage them to take a position, because there's so many changes that are taking place right now, negative changes. Many of them aren't going to go away, that we ought to take a position. One of my good friends from high school, my best friend, actually, he recently called me a piece of shit and said he's lost respect for me because I shared a video from J.P. Sears where he was like mocking people that get all their info from the mainstream media. But it was actually a really powerful video, and it touched on what you talked about, how he says, I don't like to hear competing data to the data that I consumed when I was most afraid. That's definitely got to be the truth when I was most afraid. And then later he's like, I enjoy being able to call people a conspiracy theorist, so I don't have to listen to what they have to say. I can just dismiss it. But I shared that, and 99% of the time I'm like super cordial in my conversations, but I kind of starting to lose it a little bit. But I think that that's a big factor, is that through public school especially and just upbringing, people are trained to, it's an Edward L. Bernays tactic, the father of modern propaganda, this guy Edward L. Bernays, like, we don't have to convince the entire public, all we have to do is convince the influencers and experts and authorities over certain things. So I say I'm optimistic because it's channels like the Conscious Resistance, which is this publishing on, the Survival Podcast, the alternative media is just blowing up while the mainstream media is failing. And so what are your outlooks on the future? And you think people are always going to be, I mean, obviously a big chunk of people are always going to be had, but it seems like more and more people are kind of snapping out of it.
Well, it's mixed. It's muddy because, I mean, first of all, part of all of this that you ask me, why do people not want to accept good news? Part of it is Trump derangement syndrome. I mean, it's a huge part of it. If you look at hydroxychloroquine, which is something I've been on since the very beginning, and the reason I've been on it is we know hydroxychloroquine is useful for treating coronaviruses. We've known that since the early 2000s, late 1990s, really. We also know the reason that it works is because it works as an ionophore for zinc. In other words, it makes zinc go inside the human cells. And when you put zinc inside a human cell and you get an RNA replicating virus in that cell, it shuts down or inhibits the ability of that virus to replicate itself. We know that. This is not in question. This is, well, people are like, listen to the experts, listen to science. Okay, this is well-known, and 20-year-old science in 2020 is considered old science. This medication also, the Department of Veteran Affairs alone, and this is not for soldiers in the field for malaria. This is the VA alone treating things like rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, uses about 64,000 doses a day. Okay, people taking it are not dying. But what does the media say about hydroxychloroquine? It's dangerous. It's going to kill you. It literally is in such in conflict with reality. But yet people believe it. Why? And it's only because they hate Trump. I guarantee you, if Trump had come out initially and said, I'm really skeptical about hydroxychloroquine, I think it could be dangerous. And I'm not sure that they should let people try it. The same exact people would be screaming that they should. Now, the only thing that would have changed in that is Trump's opinion. Now, Trump's opinion on science should have no impact on what anybody believes about science. If you love him, he's not a scientist, and he's not the kind of guy that you really take as – like if I had I would come to you with a question about a supplement or a drug before I would go to Donald Trump. Right. Sure. I really would. I think you probably know more. So we have that, first of all, going on where there's this division in America. And I share some optimism you have. But the other side of this is what I've been trying to explain is COVID is killing the dying. And I don't mean people. And when I say that, what I'm talking about is accelerating things that are already occurring. So we have companies that are going to go out of business or at least close 90% of the retail outlets like Macy's. Yeah. Macy's said, we're going to furlough everybody and bring them all back in July. No, you're not. Nobody believes that you're bringing those people back. And by January of next year, you would have closed those locations anyway, but COVID accelerated that. Well, another thing that's going on in America is this. We're being torn apart. We're splitting into two primary systems, and one has a, and I wish I would say that it, one loves liberty and one doesn't, would sound great, but I don't believe that. I think one has a little bit more affinity for liberty than the other. You have people like you and I, we are the minority of the minority of the minority. And when you first become a libertarian or even move to anarchism, you go through what's called messiah complex, where you become convinced that people just knew, right? So you go around, you start telling all your friends, and they're like, ah, get out of here. And you're like, and then you become intellectual, right? That's your next step, because I must be explaining this wrong. How could anybody not be for this if I was explaining it right? That's how people feel, right? And then you realize most people don't want freedom, because you can't tell me that the right wants freedom when they're totally happy to lock somebody up for the possession of a plant, right? Yeah. You can't tell me that. But the right does tend to gravitate a little bit more toward freedom. And I think with federalism, you've seen that in the way that, I mean, if you look at how every single state run by a Republican governor is behaving versus every single state run by a Democratic governor, the division is very, very evident. And I think this country was already heading toward a breakup. Now, whether that actually constitutes itself as an actual geopolitical division is, who knows? But I think we were headed towards some sort of a civil war, not necessarily killing each other, but it could happen. And I think this has accelerated that. This is why you have friends who are calling you a piece of shit, because you don't agree with them, right? Yeah. So now you had Trump derangement syndrome to COVID, and holy crap, this is like a wedge hitting this country that's never hit us before. And yeah. And my view is you're going to have bubbles of people that, you know, this group that gravitates toward more liberty, but that's actually going to entrench the established sheep more. And exactly how that plays out, I don't know, but I have what you would call muddy optimism, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I hear that. Well, I'm excited in some ways to be an active participant in it. And I'm glad that there's people like you and activists that are seeing this as an opportunity. Before we start getting into the solutions, which I really want to spend most of the time on, I want to challenge you on something. So I know that through our conversation, our discourse, that you are not so much of the mindset that there is a conspiracy, a small group of people that are manipulating world events in order to further their goal. And I want to challenge you on that. So just to preface, it's not even my belief, actually. I'll speak in terms of fact. It is a fact that there have been small secret society roundtable groups like the Milner Group that started early on and Cecil Rhodes and the Rhodes Society. And then that morphed into the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission. Of course, the Bilderberg Group is a big common one. And these groups of these individuals, the Rockefeller family and the Rockefeller Foundation, is a great personification of this whole thing. Illuminati, as some people call it, or New World Order. They have stated that their aims are to create a global government that is totalitarian in nature. They've even stated that they would like to see a reduced population in their various UN documents and stuff. It's in there. They don't come out and say, we want to kill a bunch of the population. We're going to do this through our deception. They actually do talk about using deception and secrecy. So the question is, when a pandemic like this comes around, and when we have documents like there was a Rockefeller Foundation scenario, a paper where they projected what would happen, and they had one of them called Lockstep, and they said there's going to be a pandemic, there's going to be uprisings, and the economies are going to be shut down, people are going to be sheltered in. This was like back in 2000, I think, and people are going to rise up and they're going to fight against their government. And this is one of the scenarios. And then you have Bill Gates and ID 2020, where they have an alliance of interdisciplinary non-governmental organizations, governments, corporations. Their stated agenda is to identify the entire public, right? And then you have the Gates Foundation financing programs in Rice University to not do an implantable microchip, which a lot of people are like, the vaccine's going to have the chip. I don't think that's the case. And maybe if it is, I don't know about it. It hasn't been shown, hasn't been proven, but there is like they do a micro tattoo. This is Rice University, funded by Bill Gates. So isn't it possible? And in my view, I'd like to ask you, isn't it even more likely that these individuals have positioned themselves in a position of power? They've anticipated the pandemic, whether they caused it or not is not important. But isn't it likely, or definitely possible, that this is all being played out according to a plan in order to further their goals of control, shutting down small business, and especially the big goal of getting everybody ID'd in one form or another. Let's talk about your resistance conspiracies.
And you just described Tuesday, right? COVID or no COVID, you just described Tuesday. Powerful people want more power because there's a point if you gave me or you power or money that there, if you started like, okay, John, here's $1 million, you would be like, thanks, I really appreciate it. Here's $10 million. Holy crap, great. Here's $100 million. There's a point where I would give you a number and I would hand you that money. And when you knew it was real, you'd go, stop. You would start to feel like that's actually scary to have that much money and that much power. And if I gave you $100 million, you would probably come up with a way to give about $50 million of it away. You'd probably hire somebody to go find the right places for your money to go so you knew it went to the right place. Because you're not – can I say fucking here? Is that okay?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Because you're not a fucking psychopath, right? That's why. You're not a fucking psychopath. So there's a point where you go, I don't want any more money and I don't want any more power. These people have so much money and so much power, they have to be psychopaths to want any more. Once you cross that, there is no number that you're satisfied with. It's like a kid playing a video game. They have 100 million points, but now they're going to have 500 million points. What's the difference? Doesn't matter. It's more. That's what I want. So powerful people doing the things that you're describing is as old as time. And when you put powerful people together, I mean, I've covered Bilderberg for 12 years now. When you get the most powerful people in the world, they don't play canasta. You know, they get them all out of the secret place together. Not they're playing canasta. Of course, they're conniving and trying to control everything. My issue with the conspiracy theory is once people go into that world, they reach a point where there isn't a single conspiracy they will not believe. If you're a conspiracy theorist, my first question for you is tell me one you don't believe. And if you can't immediately give me two or three, then I just kind of tune all of it out, even where you're right. It's not that I disagree with you. It's that you're at a point where this is such a big thing that almost any conspiracy theory anybody gives you, they'll believe. You talk about microchip implantation. There's no need for it. We all carry around the mark of the beast in our right hand or our forehead. We call it a phone, and we look at it like this, right? There's literally, in another generation, no need to chip anybody. Because everybody will carry their chip around and buy different little colored cases to show you their chip and tell you how wonderful it is and post their stupid videos on it and answer questions to give away all their private information, kind of already doing that. But it will only become more powerful as we move more and more to what you would call information natives, people that were born into a world where we never had a place where this wasn't the case. So how hard is it really to track most people right now? And the answer is it's not hard at all. And most people are downloading apps that allow themselves to be tracked every day. So what people call a conspiracy, I see is a natural progression of what happens in a technocratic society. This is just what happens, and this is just what's going to happen. And this whole thing that we're going to fight it is a complete and total mistake, in my opinion. Doesn't mean don't talk about it. Doesn't mean don't expose it. But you're not going to stop this. And no one's going to stop this. So what you have to figure out is, how do I benefit from it? And how do I minimize its impact on my life? How do I create as much freedom for myself as possible? And then we can also stop going too far. So like, I can't tell you how many people I've shown you. Brent mentioned Gates. If you gave me my choice, I would have Bill Gates taken up as high as a helicopter can fly and thrown out the door before I say what I'm saying. Just so everybody's clear that I'm not defending Bill Gates, but I am defending logic and reason. So there's this video that Bill Gates talks about. If we use vaccines and we use this other stuff, we can, you know, reduce the population of the world over time. Okay. So that means that we're going to put, I don't know, cyanide in the vaccinations or something like that and kill people with it or what have you. What Gates is actually talking about in that video, and it still furthers the same aim of population control, is there's a fundamental in permaculture, and that is that the reproduction of an organism is highest when that organism is closest to extinction or at highest rate of stress. And so when we push an organism toward extinction or we deeply stress an organism, its reproduction rate goes up. You want your apple tree to produce apples before it should? Stress it. And it'll produce apples when it's a single stick. It hurts the tree, but it'll do it because that's how nature works. So when Gates talks about that, in that particular instance, what he's talking about is if you make life comfortable for people, they make less babies. That's what Gates is talking about there. That's not a defense, But that's what he's talking about. And my problem with the conspiracy world is as soon as you buy into it, you can put almost anything in front of a person and they won't question it. So they become what they mock. Every conspiracy theory is true and you're just stupid if you don't believe it. I think a shitload of conspiracy theory is true. But I think there's a shitload of garbage in it too. And so I am always, I'm from Missouri, you have to show me type of thing. Until I see the evidence of what you're claiming, until it all makes sense. And then even when I do, so what? So how are you going to live your life in any way that actually matters in relationship to what you just said? Oh, they're going to do this. Okay, so what are you going to do about it? Tell Karen on Facebook? Is that really going to help? Or are you going to design your life so you can tell them to go screw and there's not a lot that they can do about it? That's the difference there. So I don't actually disagree with most of what you believe. I disagree with the application of that information, if that makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense. And I really appreciate that. And one of the biggest audiences I have is in partnership with Derek Bros, the Conscious Resistance Network. And a lot of the folks on the network are deep into conspiracy theories, even many that I'm like, now, wait a second. It's not all the Jesuits or there's some deep stuff there, right? A lot of
trading children for pizza
true.
Or something like, you know, like, and
well,
then
the Pizzagate stuff. I don't know if we want to get into that, but there's something there.
Right. So what happens is like Pizzagate. And they put this picture of Darth Vader on a wall. So that means it's true. And then it comes out that Jeffrey Epstein is clearly a pedophile and clearly enabling wealthy people to go to pedophile island. And that proves Pizzagate is true. That is as disconnected as two things. You got an island out here in the ocean, and that proves that congressmen are trading children underneath a pizza restaurant in D.C. You can have perverted, child-molesting congressmen without a pizza restaurant, and it doesn't actually make a lot of sense that they would do it that way, right? So that's a perfect example, and I've heard it all, and I've heard no compelling evidence that the pizza box proves that we're trading children. But boy, there's people that believe that, right? So that's an example where you might believe it. I'll still respect you, but I still think you're wrong. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's just how it is.
Well, I learn to decipher whenever I'm given a theory or speculating, and my speculation would lead me to believe that there was something going on with that crew and the Podesta emails and the symbolism and the language that they use. And the FBI even says that this is code words to look out for with pedophile networks. But I can't prove, there's no video, there's no smoking gun that shows it was going on there. And so I try to focus on the empirical data. And I appreciate some of the stuff you brought up. So I started in 2002.
Just real quick on that, when we talk about conspiracies and they get this complex and this involved, and then they're supposedly as big. So could there be some shit going on with somebody like Podesta hooking up some dude with some, you know, child sex trafficking scumbag? Sure. But when you go out to that big, in your professional career, have you ever been a project manager before?
Hold
have you
on,
ever done
breaking
that
up
in your
a
job? Have you
line.
Ever had
the
job
audience
of
says
project
they can hear us good.
What's that?
The audience says that they can hear us, but occasionally you're breaking up on my end. So go ahead. You're back. Why don't you repeat that question?
So I'm saying, have you ever been a project manager before?
I manage projects in my business. Yeah.
Right. And people, No. A project manager in a company with like a team of like 20 people.
No.
Okay. If you had, it'd be really hard for you to believe a lot of these conspiracy theories, because when you have 20 people paid to do what you tell them, who can get fired, and you manage a project and you see what it's like to herd that group of cats, the idea that you're going to coordinate this massive effort across this many bureaucrats become, and then if you've ever done government work and project management, you tend to realize that conspiracy works better by, I want this thing to happen. I have a certain amount of power. I know how people will react to it. So I'll put these things in motion. That works, and that's done all the time, every day. The more people you involve, the more people necessary to keep something like that going that are in on it, that are part of it, the less likely you're going to get away with it for very long before somebody opens up their mouth. Think about how many things get leaked so quickly. So we have this massive network of pedophiles in the basement of a pizza market or whatever, and there's literally nobody that says, hey, I was part of that, and I'll admit it now. or hey, I'm blowing the whistle, or hey, I'm that kid that this was done to. That's why I doubt that. Now, child sex trafficking is a point where I become almost a statist, right? Because once you do that, I don't care if you go to the state system. I don't care if you go to a wood chipper. I don't care if somebody puts you in a barn, nails
you. I think I've lost you.
All right.
Let me see if can the audience still hear both of us? Can you still hear me? Looks like I'm still live. Let me know. I definitely lost Jack. We'll try to get him back here. And nukes are nuts. Yeah, that's definitely what I was going to respond with about the strategy of compartmentalization. But we did lose Jack. So let me see if we can bring him back here. One moment. Thanks, everybody, for joining in. I wanted to dig into this topic because I appreciate what Jack has to say immensely and respect him. And I know that he's pretty hard on the conspiracy. There he is. You there, Jack?
I've been here.
There you are. Hey. All right. Well, the audience can see us both, but for some reason you tap out for me. So let me just respond to that and let's move on to the solutions, right? Because we could debate this for hours. Yeah. There is a strategy of compartmentalization that is utilized in intelligence agencies, and I believe it's likely utilized for these conspiracy theories. And that's where it's like people need to know things on a need-to-know basis. And who knows exactly how deep this pedophile ring goes, but I think it's probably, and again, most likely that there are some people, and we know through the Jeffrey Epstein stuff, when things can be proven, that's most likely runs pretty damn deep. And so I have heard that objection to a lot of conspiracies, the compartmentalization, and things would leak if there were so many people. And, you know, oftentimes, like with 9/11, things do leak. And you do have like Sybil Edmonds, for example, the CIA agent, or maybe she was FBI, that started blowing the whistle on being told to stand down and stand down orders. And then you have like who was he? He was one of the White House staff persons when 9/11 was happening and Dick Cheney was telling him to shoot down the planes and that slipped up, right? And so a lot of these conspiracies, even as big as 9/11, there are little holes that end up coming out. Rudy Giuliani saying that we knew the towers were going to come down, so we had to move our stuff. So, but I want to draw this distinction. I want to give some advice perhaps to a lot of the conspiracy theorists that are watching that our position is far more compelling when we leave the speculation at the door or on the floor, whatever the expression is, and we focus on empirical evidence, video, science, physics, pictures, even though all that can be doctored and manipulated. And that's what I started doing along 2002. And early on, when I started with just conspiracies and I was totally drinking the Alex Jones Kool-Aid, I thought that it was all a conspiracy and every single world event and every piece of political action that took place was part of this grand conspiracy. Then when I learned more about libertarianism, I started to understand self-interest and the idea that there can be politicians that are doing shitty things because they're trying to make more money for themselves, gain more power, or which is often some of the worst type of stuff when they actually genuinely think they're doing good for people. And I also reached a conclusion which caused me to maybe take a step back from the conspiracy theory stuff because I was early on 9/11 Truth 2002. That's when I challenged people with a lot of this QAnon stuff. And I'm like, I'm not sure that – do you have a source for that? And they're like, you haven't been paying attention. You need to do your research. It's like, brother, I've been doing research since probably when you were like in elementary school. And so I realized early on, though, I banged my head against the wall for a good 5 to 10 years trying to wake people up about 9/11. And it reached a point where in 2002, I bring up 9/11 Truth and people would shout me down. I got kicked out of my ACC college class for doing a talk on it for being unpatriotic. Well, fast forward 5, 10 years, and there's more and more people that are like, yeah, I do believe that the official story is BS. But the point is, I think there's been a critical mass of people that believe the official story is bogus and that maybe US government had something to do with it or at least let it happen. But like you said, so what?
Well, there's exactly been no justice. So what, right? So in that
the police instance, state marches on, the DHS is still there.
I don't think you can.
So it's like, what are we going to do about it?
Anyway, I don't know if you can hear me again, John, but you can put me in that list of people that do not believe that 9/11 happened the way that it was explained. But yeah, exactly. So what? In fact, I would say there's probably at least half of Americans today that believe more what truthers say, if you want to use that word, than the official storyline. And what difference has it made? Has it changed anything?
What are we going to do about it?
They're not going to do shit. Most people aren't. Even if you convince them that you're right, they're not going to do anything. And you used a very important word there, and that's how you get solutions, self-interest. you teach people what's in their best interest for them to do. And so the number one way you create a libertarian is create a small business owner. You want to create a libertarian, create a small business owner. It's much easier to do. It's very easy to convince somebody to take a shot and go establish a business. Let them make their own money. Let them pay double the Social Security. Let them see all of the regulations. Let them see all the things that hold them back. Let them kill themselves. Let them pour everything they have for 2 or 3 or 4 years into something and just be getting ahead barely at that point. And understand somebody wants a little bit more now, and you have a new libertarian. It's way easier. Teach the person to act in their self-interest, and they'll move toward liberty because, well, liberty's in your self-interest.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now let's get on to that, right? So people can tell people about conspiracies till they're blue in the face. I think that helps to undermine the legitimacy of the state when people are like, oh my God, I can't believe the government is capable of that. It makes it easier for them to tiptoe along towards total freedom. But at the end of the day, I think the most effective way to get people pulled out of their slumber and building the free society we all want and deserve is through practical doing action. So let's spend the rest of our talk, maybe about 20 more minutes before we wrap up, on practical tips and solutions specifically for survival. So when it comes to the context of we have lockdowns, pandemic, food shortages in some areas, potential further economic collapse, maybe even a depression that we could be led right into because of these problems, what are some of the starter things? Maybe let's talk in the context of someone that just lives in an apartment or lives in the city. Maybe they have a small garden in the back. They don't have much going on. What are some of the first steps that you would encourage people to take in order to get more secure?
See, the problem with that question is we're in the middle of crisis right now. It's yeah. Like saying, what is the basic things people can do for fire safety while that person's home is beginning to be engulfed in flames? So I hate to be this way, but if you have done nothing up till this point, this is one of the hardest times to get started there's ever been, because there's restrictions on your movement. There's restrictions on your spending. There's a collapse of the economy. There's an increase in cost. And I said for 12 years, it's so cheap to be prepared. I don't know why everybody wouldn't do it. It's the cheapest form of insurance there is in the world. Food is cheap. You can do anything you want pretty much. So the problem right now is all the basic stuff that you do to kind of slowly ramp up is a lot more difficult to do, because we teach things like copy canning, and it applies more to just than canned food, but it's a good way to understand it. So let's say you buy a particular food item in a can, and you buy a can of that a week. So you just start buying three, and then you put them in your pantry and you line them up, and you put the oldest item in the front and the newest item in the back. And you keep doing that until it goes all the way to the back, until you have, let's say, 3 months worth of that, and pick another item. And maybe you're doing 2 or 3 or 4 things at a time. Like, that's the easiest way to build up your pantry. Right now, you almost have to buy what you can get when you can get it in a lot of instances. And then, so the getting started thing, man, I wish I could say like it's all the same as it used to be. And it right now, it really isn't. And I guess, though, the way that you have to think about this to figure out what, because I don't know what it's like for you when you go to the supermarket, and you and I don't know what it's like for the person in Bud Lake, New Jersey, when they go to the supermarket. So how can I tell you or them what to do? Right. So the way to think about this is, I don't care if it's COVID. I don't care if it is a recession. I don't care if it's a depression. I don't care if it only happened to you and it screwed up your life. What we prepare for isn't, you know, a coronal mass ejection from the sun. It isn't global thermonuclear war. We prepare to deal without systems of support. So the way that you get started is, and you should be in touch with this a lot more than most people have been in the past. That's one of the good things about it. What are all the things that you depend on outside sources for? And how do you become either self-sufficient or self-reliant in that system? And that is two phrases people put together. They don't belong together. They're totally different things. Self-sufficient means I don't need outside sources for this. And I can go on infinitely without an outside source, right? Self-reliance is how long I can exist, a time bank, without that outside source. So if I buy beans, I'm not a big bean eater, but let's say I buy dry beans. I have 6 months worth of beans, but I don't grow any beans. I'm exactly zero self-sufficient, but I'm 6 months self-reliant. Does that make sense? And so you start figuring out for you in your situation, where does it make most sense to develop self-sufficiency, and where does it make the most sense to develop self-reliance? Because you might figure out it makes a hell of a lot more sense for you to buy an $800 generator and you know, 120 gallons worth of gasoline than to spend $20,000 to put solar panels on your roof that will never actually run your life the way that you want it to yet anyway. You see what I'm saying? Or you got to figure out for you, how do I extend this quotient of self-sufficiency and self-reliance based on my income, my threat tolerance, where I live, my geographic risks? Because everybody's like, oh, gee, now it's recession that's the problem, or possibly depression. I've always said, if you get a pandemic, you get a recession. Now, government pulled one on me here and responded to this one so draconian and made it so much worse than it had to be that even I'm like, holy shit, this is what we've done to ourselves. This is the biggest self-inflicted wound that history has ever recorded. No one's ever done this much damage to themselves when it didn't have to happen, I believe, ever. I mean, the only thing else you could even compare it to would be a war, but at least in a war, you're dropping your bombs on the other guy. This is literally, we're bombing our own cities economically. But we were always going to get this, and I always thought we would get exactly what we have. Like, this was my – like, I didn't see this as the one, which everybody found really astounding, because I was always the one that said, my biggest concern for the world is a pandemic. And the way they've responded here, the reason it didn't surprise me in the end is if this – let's say this was a different type of pandemic, John. Let's say this was the original SARS, and it spread like this, and we did have a death rate like the original SARS. Let's say 20% of the people that got this were dying, and we didn't have 80,000, 800,000, who knows how many asymptomatic cases. Like, when somebody got sick, you saw it, and 15% of those people died, and it spread the way this is. They would do exactly what they're doing now, because you tell me what else they could do. This is the only solution you have if you get that level of pandemic. It's like, we got a pandemic that's nowhere near that bad, and we took the extreme response of a lockdown and a like, they call it quarantine, but it's not a quarantine. This is not quarantine. Quarantine is where you get sick, I put you in quarantine. This is house arrest. And my big concern here, when we talk about optimism, is the optimism is that people are basically saying at this point, that's nice that you want us to lock down, we're not going to do it. The lockdowns are ending because people are deciding to end the lockdowns. And that's another thing that I said would happen earlier. People are like, we're going to stay locked down for 18 months. No, we're not. Because Bill, who can't feed his kids, is going to, you know, all this crap, all you people out there that are going to get together and you're going to have this open up demonstration in Austin or Dallas or whatever. Don't do that. Go to work. Get everybody, just instead of screaming and yelling, we want to open up, you just open up. And that's what's going to happen. The downside is, if we got a real pandemic, when I say real, I'm talking about high death rate, high mortality, really overloading the hospitals, not just in a couple of trouble spots, but everywhere at one time. As much as it sucks, this would be what you would have to do. So what happens 5, 10, 15 years from now when we get something that is that and everybody says, we're not doing it this time, and you get noncompliance at a point where people shouldn't be compliant because the government said so. If I thought my odds of dying were actually really high, if I spent a lot of time in social situations, guess what I would do? Not do that. No one would have to tell me, right? My entire life has been predicated around developing the ability to bug in or to bug out whenever my odds of survival are increased by doing either one. So if you get me to that state, I'll do it naturally. I think we're heading to a point where we may get the real pandemic that I always thought was coming, something with that 15% lethality rate, or even the 2.7% they say this is, because it isn't. A real 2.7% with a higher spread rate, and you are looking at hundreds of millions of people dead around the world, and everybody's going to say, it's the boy that cried wolf. That's actually my big concern long term now.
Yeah, I can hear that. So you said bug in or bug out. Tell us what people ought to weigh when they choose whether to bug in, hunker down. If they're able, they need to be prepared to hunker in and hunker down or bug out. What are some of the things that should go into someone's thought process when deciding which would be better for them and their family?
So if you go to any, like today, it's all Facebook groups and stuff like that. It used to be old school when I started all forums and stuff. This was the big debate that people would have for hours and hours and hours that could be settled that fast. Bugging in, you bug in when your odds of surviving are greatest by bugging in. Bug out, you bug out when your odds of surviving are better by bugging out. It's that simple. So people would have this debate with me, and I had one guy, all my comfort items are in my home. Why would I ever bug out? Because there's a flood. Because the hurricane's coming. Because there's an earthquake and your house fell down on top of your head. Because there was a fire. Because there's a forest fire. And a there's 100 reasons you would bug in.
Right.
So then people say, well, if you know everybody's coming to get me, why would I bug in? They'll come get me. Well, because maybe they're not. Because maybe there's a pandemic, and the best thing that you can do to survive is bug in. Maybe you're bugging in because the government made you. Right. So when this happened, my life, see, I try to stay cognizant of this and not downplay the actual problem, because the actual problem is the lockdown, right? I try not to downplay that to other people, like so many of the virtue signalers do out there with, oh, all you have to do is stay home and stream Netflix or whatever. Like, I don't really care about social distancing. I don't like most people anyway. I like to be alone. I like the quiet. I have 3-acre property, right? I can go out there and I have created this amazing property for myself. You tell me to stay home? Fine. I don't care. But the average person wasn't prepared for this. They're sitting there with a freezer that's about as big as a laptop, about that deep, and they're trying to store meat. Good luck with that. Like, when all the meat started disappearing, I'm like, it'll come back because people are going to max out their capacity. And right now, have you checked how long you have to wait to buy a deep freezer right now?
No.
August.
Wow.
That's the earliest delivery date on a chest freezer. So if you didn't have a chest freezer, you don't have a chest freezer. You're not stockpiling meat. So bugging in is probably the thing that we should spend the most time preparing to do, because it's the most likely thing that we'll have to do. And if it's doable, it's almost always preferable. Do you want to stay in a tent in the woods, at a shelter, or in your house? Like, if you have those choices, most people would want to stay in their house or their apartment or whatever. But then you have to look again at critical risk. Like, if you had the ability, let's say you had two places you could live and your primary residence was in New York City, I hope you went to your other one. And that's sort of bugging out. You're bugging out to your own property. Like, of course, Gretchen, what's her name, Whitmore, interfered with that in Michigan, where she said if you had an upstate place, you couldn't go to your own house. I'm sure people went anyway. But you see what I'm saying? Like, you go wherever it makes the most sense for you, but then you need to be prepared to do that. So a lot of people think, well, so bugging out, I'll have my bug out bag. Well, a bug out bag, 72-hour kit. So it's designed to keep you relatively comfortable, alive, safe for 3 days. Well, what if you can't go home? So your bug out plan has to be a hell of a lot more than a bug out bag. And John's gone again. Anyway, I don't see the chat or anything, guys, so I don't know if y'all can hear me or not.
Again, that would be ideal. Now we're back. Next time I do an interview, for those who are watching, I'm going to have my router set up. I've gone through two routers, and neither one of them worked. But okay, so if you bug in, obviously one of the most important things you can do is focus on food production. So why don't you hit us on some critical things that people can do in their backyard or on their 3 acres in order to have some self-sufficiency when it comes to food?
When it comes to food, like, this is another one of those places that people always think they're going to do it someday. And you got to start wherever you are. You got to start now. And you got to be realistic.
It's not as easy as people think it is. It takes a lot of work to go from seed to the fruit. And
yeah. Well, and this, you know, the whole survival seed bank. So this person has, like, they can plant a 2-acre garden and they're going to put it in a tube and bury it in the ground or whatever. And that just doesn't work. So to me, if you want to produce your own food, you need to start now. And then you need to be realistic about what you're not going to be able to produce. And you need to store that. So, like, if you're going to store wheat, don't buy it. I'm sorry, you know, store wheat, don't grow it. Like, wheat is a dumb thing to grow in your backyard, unless you are a wheat farmer, right?
Yeah.
It's so much labor and so much work and so much space to produce a relatively small amount of something you can buy for next to nothing. And, like, even the wheat disappeared when people all freaked out when this whole thing started. And you got, like, so if you end up in a situation where you need food, don't go where everybody else is. Like, what was the first place to run out of toilet paper? Was Costco and Sam's Club and Walmart. So don't go there. Go somewhere else before they run out too. When wheat was all I people, I want to get 50 pounds of wheat. I'm like, well, I don't think you need to, but go to a homebrew store. Go to a feed store. You get all the wheat you want. So, you know, think about those big commodity crops that store well. Buy that and store that. When it comes to production, the easy thing to grow, and this is why the poor people of the world live on it, is vegetables. And quick turn vegetables, leafy greens, perennial vegetables, and things like that. So you have to start. Like, I really can't answer this question from a holistic standpoint in the time that we have here. But that's kind of where you want to start your stuff. And then, can you produce eggs? Can you produce meat? And some people, the answer is yes, and some is no. Your number one animal for the production of eggs and meat is what almost nobody does: quail. I know a guy that keeps a stack of quail in a one car garage in Michigan that produces like 20,000 eggs a year out of that, and like 1,200 meat quail out of a single stack of quail in a garage. There's a 6-week turn. Like, that would be quail for meat and eggs. For meat, it's rabbits. They're quiet. You can keep them almost anywhere. When you start looking at like chickens, I keep ducks, cattle, goats, all of that. You got to move into farming. You got to have the area where they let you do that. So if that's going to be lacking, then like I said, you need ways to store that extra protein. So for years, people got to me about the protein and say, like, how are you going to maintain your, because I'm a ketogenic guy, right? How are you going to maintain that diet? Like, you don't have a cattle farm or whatever. I got a deep freezer and a generator and another deep freezer, another generator and another deep freezer. And guess what? A third generator. And that's, you have to start thinking about that way, about your food from a standpoint of your own production. Produce what you can, but then you better bunk up on the long-term viability, that self-reliant component to the stuff you can't produce. And don't lull yourself into believing you'll be able to produce it. Now, the fastest production of vegetables that I've ever done, I started experimenting with this year, is hydroponics. Hydroponics was something I resisted for a decade. I thought it was sterile or whatever. And as soon as, and I, you know, I can't explain hydroponics in 10 minutes, but I'm telling you guys, look into it, specifically look into Kratky hydroponics, because it doesn't need a pump. And you can produce from seed to salad in 30 days or less, including indoors using lights. I mean, that would be another thing to look at with that.
Yeah. I found we had lived on a 2.5-acre farmstead for a while. That's where both my kids were born. My life changed actually pretty dramatically when we lost that location. But we had at one point like 115 chickens, and they just started breeding with themselves, and we let them do their little thing, and they were popping out chicks left and right. And I actually found that it was easier to maintain that giant flock than it was to maintain the vegetables, especially keeping the damn chickens out of the little farm area. Definitely having opportunity for meat. And then I appreciate how you're talking about focus on the stuff that's easy with quick turnaround, like okra and squash grows so damn easy here in Texas. Yeah. Same thing with tomatoes. They're just popping off and just boom, 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 boom. So I've never been able to take corn from seed to fruit. I've found that to be extremely difficult. So yeah,
our climate is really bad for that. Where I grew up in Pennsylvania, you could almost like just take the corn and throw it in a place, and then there would be corn. Like here, it's miserable trying to grow corn. I don't know how anybody does it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Just don't do it, like you said.
Yeah, just don't do it. No, why would you? Corn is cheap. You know, if you really want to store calories, you can go buy a couple bags of deer corn and make corn nuts with fry oil, right? I mean, like, I'm not suggesting you do it, but if you really just want corn in your life, there's a lot of ways to do it other than growing it. It's a long grow cycle, and it's very subject to pests. But where do you live? If you live in central Pennsylvania, God honest truth, you can grow all the corn you want. It's easy. And you think I'm like, when you hear me say corn's hard to grow, you're like, what the hell's wrong with him? He's supposed to be a permaculturist. He can't grow corn. Well, come to central Texas and ask John and try to grow corn in central Texas, and you'll find it's a totally different world.
Yeah. Okay, cool. All right. Well, I'd like to keep going on with more stuff, but let's go ahead and field some questions real quick.
Sure.
And then I'll let you go. I appreciate your time and coming on the Live Free Now podcast. Somebody asked earlier if you're still into keto and carnivore.
I am into keto. I have never been into carnivore. I've always been kind of a high veg, low carb keto guy. Since I went into this, I let my health go to crap a few years ago, really bad. And in August, I had kind of a health scare, and I decided, like, I'm too young to go out that way. And I went full keto, and I've been there, and I've never left it. And I drink very little now as well, and I've stayed with that. Carnivore, I find intriguing. I find it useful. And what I've used carnivore for in this journey since August, where I've lost about 65 pounds since August of last year, is when you get stuck. So you're going along, you're doing your keto thing, you're doing everything right, you're checking your macros, you're watching your caloric intake, you're doing everything the way you're supposed to, and you just stop, and you still have weight to lose, right? And you just stick. And doing like a week of carnivore seems to unstick you, and then going back to, you know, a lot of vegetables and stuff like that, no problem. But when I say keto, the one thing I got to be clear with, I'm not talking about sitting around eating big old gobs of like pizza balls or something like that, because there's no dough in it. I'm talking about following a plan, staying with the macro numbers on your even, and when you're doing weight loss, even the calorie thing. Now I've gotten down to a weight where I want to lose about another 5 pounds. And so I work on it, lose a pound or two, and then I just go to more of a freestyle. And what I've determined is the people that say that you can go keto, you can eat as much as you want, as long as you don't break the rules and not gain weight, absolutely correct. I have not put a pound back on in this journey at all. However, if you're 65 pounds overweight and you start that way, you may even have a week or two where it falls, but you will plateau, and then you've convinced yourself that you really can eat as much as you want. A pound of human fat, I believe, has something like 4,400 calories in it. It's like if we take a pound of human fat, it's either 3,200 or 4,400, somewhere in that range. You can't be eating an excess of 8,000 calories a week and burn 4,000. That's not going to happen. That doesn't biochemically work. I think your body will eliminate the excess if it doesn't need it and if your hormones are right. But if you've screwed your life up and you're going to take this journey, folks, get Nazi on it, man. You got to be Nazi keto until the weight comes off. And then you can live more of like a paleo. You can live very paleo once you get the weight off. But to get that weight off, and then I guess part of that too is how long. Like I did this shit to myself for 10 years, right? And I knew better and I did it to myself for 10 years. So I had to go on really aggressive therapy. But yeah, and I'll never go back, and I'll never go back to eating any other way.
Right on. Yeah, I did keto for a couple months and I found that I was in the best shape of my life and I had the best energy. And it's a struggle for me because I really like fruit smoothies and it's hard for me to keep the sugar down. The carbs I can handle more, except I like my popcorn and my gluten-free hamburger buns. But all right, here's another question.
On that with your hamburger buns. They're called carb balance tortillas. Put butter on them, throw them in a pan, toast both sides of them. Put your burger on that. You won't miss your bun. Those things are great for everything. Now go ahead.
Right on. All right. I'll give that a try because I like burgers. It's hard to let those go. Patricia Croft, tell me if you can see this. Do you see that question there on your screen?
Does he have any plans if he gets trapped?
Cool. She says.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's tapped, I guess, meaning like if you get a test and positive for COVID-19, what would change in your life, if anything?
Honestly, what I'm doing now is specifically so if I am exposed to or get COVID, and that is a nutritional regime that I really don't have time to go through all of it, but it centers on the use of a supplement called Quercetin, which one of the scientists that did a lot of research into the original SARS had very promising results to. And I mentioned earlier that hydroxychloroquine is an ionophore for zinc. Well, so is Quercetin. So I take Quercetin and zinc, and that's my primary plan to keep my health up. I also A, B, C, D, E vitamins at significant levels. And I take the Quercetin and the zinc both in the evening and the morning every day, divide it up, don't exceed recommended dose. I also take green tea extract in my morning dose, which I use a small amount of, but that's actually an ionophore for zinc as well. And to me, and again, I'm not a doctor, I don't claim anything, I'm just saying the science that I've investigated, the number one thing you can do for any RNA replicating virus is get zinc inside your cells. And you can take zinc till you overdose on it and still have very little zinc inside your cell unless you have an ionophore to go along with it. And Quercetin is the most powerful over-the-counter cheap ionophore for zinc that I can find. This, and you can go to my site, and if you just type Quercetin, you'll find a complete write-up on this. I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on TV, but this has been looked at by – I've had multiple scientists, multiple pharmacologists, multiple doctors look at this. The most prestigious person that looked at it was an infectious disease specialist with 30 years in the infectious disease specialty practice. The first thing he did after he looked at my research was he went out and bought all this stuff for his family. So that's my primary plan. If I get sick, I would continue that, and then I would use whatever course of treatment makes sense. I would absolutely demand of my doctor, and if he would say no, I would find a doctor who would do this, hydroxychloroquine with zinc. And I got plenty of zinc, so just give me the hydroxychloroquine. And I think that the biggest lie that we've heard about this is the intentionally flawed studies on hydroxychloroquine. So the doctors come out that use this and say, use it early, as quick as possible with zinc. So all the studies are people laying on their stomach inverted with a respirator, crushing it up and putting it down a feeding tube when all the damage has already been done to their body. So that would be my first line of treatment, hydroxychloroquine with zinc. And if your doctor says you can tolerate it, zithromycin as well.
Right on. Okay, cool. I can appreciate that. And another thing too, like one thing about these percentages, the percentages of mortality rate, it doesn't necessarily mean, I know you're aware of this. It doesn't necessarily mean that if you get the infection, then that's the chances of you dying. Nor does it even mean I got chewed out by someone, an elderly person on Facebook. Yeah. So I was like, yeah, there's a great chance of dying if you're over this age. And they're like, now hold on a second. I'm over this age and I could probably get it and do just fine. I think a lot of people think that these mortality rates mean if they get it, they're going to roll some dice and that's the chances that they have. So, and you're already doing the preventative measures.
You could get it and be 95 and have a very case, and you could get it and be 15 and have a very severe case. But the odds are very low of both of those things, right?
Yeah.
And that's just the way life works. But if you're 95, honestly, you're at a point in your life where sooner or later, some bug is going to give you pneumonia and kill you is the most likely way that you'll die. It's not the only way you could die, but it is the most likely way we die as elderly people. That's just the way it is. And that doesn't mean that I don't care about them. It doesn't mean you just want old people to die. I'm sure you hear that all the time, John. I hear it all the time.
Killing people.
No, I want to protect them as best that we can. But I'm also not for taking this one rare case of this one person who was really healthy, who got sick and died or almost died, and using it to scare everybody either. Yeah, because the odds are whatever the odds are for you. It doesn't even matter what they are for everybody else. And your life's a risk. Get in a car, you have a chance of dying. You know, I mean, that's – I used to jump out of airplanes. I mean, life has risks. You put your socks on, leave the house, you took a risk.
Yeah. I think Thomas Jefferson said, I'd rather live in dangerous liberty than certain or peaceful, tranquil tyranny. And that rings really true today.
And so would everybody else, or nobody would fear going to jail.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's people, you can tell different people with different risk aversions and the risk that they're willing to take on. Even within my own family, there's big differences between what I'm doing and what my siblings are doing. For example, I think it's important to honor everyone as long as they're not being total Karens and trying to like screw up people's lives that are going a little bit above and beyond when it comes to going out again. But I try to have compassion for people, especially compassion. Like, I don't watch mainstream news. We have TVs, but we use Netflix, YouTube, Amazon Prime. We choose what we're going to watch, right? But every once in a while, check in on the ABC Nightly News Hour or whatever on YouTube, and it is some sophisticated propaganda. It reminds me of after 9/11 with all the graphics and the red charts and the numbers and stuff. And, of course, they show the cumulative deaths, that chart that's always getting higher rather than showing the daily.
That's the one. There's more. Well, it's cumulative, so of course there's more. Right?
And so then, I have like, compassion for folks.
You know, you tell people something like, look, according to IHME, who everybody's basing this on, the denominator is somewhere between 6 and 25x, what the reported number is. No, it's not. So you show them on IHME's new site, because they changed it all up because the old one was an embarrassment and they needed to make it go away because all their predictions never happened. And you say, you see this number? This is the number of new cases on this day. This is their estimated number of new cases. This number is 16 times larger than this number. They won't believe that because nobody came on the TV and said the estimated number of cases today was, you know, really 200. Like, there's one day that we had like 25,000 reported cases, and IHME now estimates there were 270,000 new cases on that day. Now, what does that do to your death rate? What does that do to your risk rates? What does that do to everything? It drops them by 25, 30 fold. That's what it does. Yep. And like, when you say that, it's not because I want grandma to die. It's because math. And you wonder why they teach Common Core, John. Because you and I can do that math in our head and go, wow, that just, right? But if you're doing Common Core, I guess you're drawing circles now to figure it out. Are there any more questions before we?
It's trouble. Yeah, last question here. Question, Jack, you once talked about an intentional community build ended up being too costly. What are your thoughts on buying up an old dying town? And maybe you can just talk about intentional communities in general as a solution to all the crazy stuff going on.
It's really, really difficult. I mean, I have an incredible reach. When I decided I wanted to do it, I put out some forms and said, here's two different ways you could partake in this, and here's what the cost would be. And I was able to do an estimated raise of capital of $5.5 million in 48 hours. And then a person from the FTC who likes what I do instead of doesn't like what I do came to me and said, if you do this, they will put you in federal prison. And then I had people going, you should do this anyway. And I went, no, I'm not going to federal prison. Really hard to fight for liberty from federal prison. I ain't Nelson Mandela or whatever, you know. And then even when we did something, it became very difficult to wrangle people into this. This is why I said, if you've a lot of these ideas that sound great, if you've never been a project manager, they're like, oh, well, we'll just do that. If you've ever been a project manager before, you're like, yeah, okay, I get why there's a problem here. The way I've seen this done, where it's actually worked, has never been a bunch of people get together and create a libertarian commune. I've never seen that work. What I've seen work is one person move to a place and start doing a thing and then saying, you know what? There's a house over there for sale. And I can have some influence on who my next neighbor would be. And they go out to their network and they say, hey, if you like what I do, there's a house for sale here. And the beauty of that is, if that house is $500,000 house, if your network's big enough, there's someone that can afford it. And if it's $100,000 house, there's someone that can, there's always somebody out there who sees things your way. And then you have a house and they have a house. Because what you'll find is you and I agree a lot and we disagree a lot. And I have my place and you have your place. And the big thing we agree about is unless I'm actually hurting you, I should be, and I'm, unless I'm hurting somebody else, I should be able to do anything I want on my property. And so should you. So we have these boundaries now. We have these borders, real borders, that are defined by the fact that I tendered capital for this place and I've rightfully acquired it, and I can defend that border, and that means it's an actual real border that you respect. I don't have to put a – now, I put up a fence, but if I put up a fence around my property, it's probably to keep my dog from killing your chickens. It's not to keep you off my property. You kind of just respect. That's Jack's place, and I go when he invites me under the terms he and I respect that the other way. And that's how I've seen intentional communities work. A dying town might be a great place to do that. It might be a really great place to do that. One place I saw this work out was, of all places, California, and it was kind of a dying town. And what happened is a guy moved in, and he made his little permaculture backyard and said, gee, I wish I had more land. Got another person to move in next door. First thing they did was take the dividing fence between their property down, and they ended up with almost a whole block. The fences are still up, but none of the cross fences are back fences. So now there's like a couple acres that everybody are kind of sharing, and the kids play, and it's like a park, and one person grew a mulberry tree and the other person takes care of the chickens and the chickens go eat under the mulberry tree. And that all seems to work better than the concept of let's create, you know, Jackville or Johnville. I love the idea, but it's so rare that it works. It's rarer than hen's teeth, as we say here in Texas, right? Like, you just don't see a lot of that happening. And when you do, it's almost always the case where don't anybody take this wrong. One of my best friends in the world is Paul Wheaton. But Paul Wheaton doesn't have an intentional community. He has a voluntary dictatorship. And he's the first one to tell you that, right? It's Paul's world. You don't like it? Get out. Bye. Right? When you come here, that's not, to me, nothing wrong with it. Everybody should have the freedom. If you want to live with your own Duke of Permaculture overseeing his duchy and you want to live on that, that's fine. But when you say intentional community to me, what I'm thinking is John's got his place, I've got mine, and we work together. Nicole Sauce from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast has done a better job of this than anybody else I've seen. And all they really have done is said, hey, here's a place for sale. Let's go out to that network and let people know. And I think that's probably the best way to do that. And I'm trying to do it here. Like, when I see a house go for sale, I get on Instant Messenger and what have you, and I let everybody I know, hey, man, check this place out. And what I also do is, like, so if a place goes up for sale and it's $500,000 place, my buddy Brian Black, I'll text him that link, right? But the guy I know that works, you know, for Lockheed that makes $15 an hour, he's not going to buy it. Why would I annoy him with that? But when the more affordable place goes up for sale, then I'll send that. You know what? So that makes sense. And I think that, like, that's the best thing you can do is, like, people naturally move away and you naturally move in the people you want. You're big on freedom cells and stuff like that. You've been talking about that a lot lately. I think if you want to put a group together, around a more general idea and let the concept of having each other's back naturally form. Every place I've seen that work, you know, you get people together because they're in a hunting club or a rod and gun club, or they're in a gardening club or something like that.
Free State Project.
Right. Exactly. It's easy to do it in Free State because you got 20,000 people. I guess like 10 actually moved. Right. So there's a huge number of people that if you say, hey, we're doing this, that are just there to do it. We don't all have that. But if you put something together like a gardening instructional club, you can put that on next door and Karen will even come. But when you see Karen, you're like, hey, Karen, here's how you grow begonias and make Karen happy. But you also, like, when John, like when I'm there and if I'm running something like that and John Bush shows up, it ain't going to be long before you and I figure out that we're a little more alike than I am with Karen, right? And then so in that group, there'll be a naturally occurring subgroup. There'll even be a naturally occurring subgroup of Karens. That's great. They can go make pesto together, right? But there's going to be a natural John Jack component to that group. And the bigger that group gets, the bigger that subgroup will get. And then you let that relationship lead. Every time I've seen somebody try to put together like a prepper group, you know, any kind of anarcho group or anything like that, and that's what they come out and that's what they're looking for from the beginning, it never seems to really gather momentum or steam, because like if I see that, then I'm like, okay, well, are you crazy? Because there is a component among us that's crazy. You and I both know that. You know crazy. You've seen crazy. You've seen crazy, right? I've seen like crazy eyes crazy. The other thing is it a Fed? Right? Because that is a thing. You know, you talk about conspiracy theories. Once you start talking words like survivalist, prepper, freedom, whatever, it attracts Feds. Even if you build a group, so you build a group and you're trying to expand that group and it's built around that ideology publicly, and somebody sticks their hands up and says they want to be part of it, what is your first thought? Are you a Fed? And if you're not thinking that way, maybe you should be, because there's a history of that type of thing going on. But a gardening group doesn't really attract the Feds, right? So a gardening group or a fishing group or a hunting group or something like that. Where I grew up in Pennsylvania, we had rod and gun clubs that took the place of bars. There was a lot of subgroups that were built out of something like that. Or we had volunteer fire departments. That created tons of subgroups. If you're into guns and gardens, you're probably into Liberty. I don't know a lot of people that are into those two things or not. That's just something to think about.
Yeah. I appreciate the more organic approach, kind of just let it play out and pan out.
Lead with the relationship.
And common interest. Lead with common interest. Cool. Okay, great. I'd love to dive more into that topic, but we're already at an hour and 20 minutes. So let me just leave with this last comment here. Third Eye Vision 11 says, super stoked to see Jack on the Conscious Resistance. My two favorite content sources. Your episode on mental health last week was much appreciated, Jack. So
thank you, man.
We got some common listeners. So I really appreciate you coming on and sharing some of your insights, some of your wisdom on survivalism with us. We'll definitely have you back on the future. Do you want to share where people can check out your podcast and follow some of your work?
Yeah. Check me out. You can find me at thesurvivalpodcast.com, or if you don't want to type all those letters in, tspc.co. Everything's there. 2,600 plus episodes, been going now for over 12 years. About a quarter million listeners a day. So if that many people are listening and like it, you might like it too. And if you have a subject you want to know more about, I promise you in 2,600 episodes, we've covered it. There's a search bar. I keep all my podcasts archived for free all the way back to number one. Don't listen to number one until you listen to a few though, because number one sucked. But that's a little encouragement there at the end, man. If there's something you guys want to do, don't worry about getting it right before you start doing it. When I started doing this show, I did it with a $20 recorder that sat in my lap. I didn't even have a microphone, driving down the road, and I built it into a full-time income in 18 months. You can make what sucks into something good as long as you get started.
Right on. Good words. All right, Jack, thanks for coming on. I want to encourage everyone out there to live free, not later, but now. Peace and freedom. Thanks, Jack.
Take care, man.